You're listening to On the Job with Porak, hosted by Porak President Brian Marvel and Vice President Damon Kurtz. On the Job with Porak is your go-to podcast for insights into the challenges and opportunities facing law enforcement professionals here in California and across the nation. Our goal is to provide an inside look at these issues from the perspective of officers who risk their lives to protect and serve their communities.
With me today, I have Tim Talbot from the RLS Law Firm and David Mastagni from Mastagni Holstead Law Firm. And today we're here to talk a little bit about the Porak v. Bonta. It's the RIPA board case that we filed. It's in regards to standing up for our officers' rights to not have to identify their gender. So I want to first thank you for being here and talking about this case. You know, obviously, we try to avoid litigation at all possible costs. And, you know, I know in this circumstance, we were able to, we sent out letters saying, hey, we had concerns regarding some changes, some policy changes within RIPA and the way that our officers are having to fill out those data cards. And then not hearing anything, obviously, for a little bit. We had to file a case, which both of you handle as Porak's representatives on that. So first off, I want to thank you for being here, but thank you for handling this case for us. So why don't we start off with David a little bit? Can you talk a little bit about maybe how did we get to where we had to file the case?
And thank you for having both of us here this afternoon. And really, I think I'm speaking on behalf of Tim, too. It's a privilege and a pleasure to represent Porak and the other law enforcement organizations in this litigation. So how this came to our attention through you, obviously, was when these new regulations got published, for the first time, officers had to disclose some of the most intimate, private, personal information about themselves, which is surprising since RIPA had been focused on the perceived identities of people that officers stopped or interacted with. And so from our perspective, we were a little bit dumbfounded as, you know, in terms of what does the gender identity of the officer have to do with the perceived race or other information regarding the stop that they had. So we did a little bit of research, and Tim and I collaborated on that. And we discovered that that question violates different regulations under the Fair Employment and Housing Act that prohibits any employer in California, including public employers, from requiring their employees to disclose that information as a condition of employment. So we gathered all of that information, sent a letter over to the Attorney General, and we asked them to reconsider this regulation in light of that new information that it appeared they hadn't considered. And we were just waiting and waiting, and we never got an actual response to that letter.
So with that, Tim, what was our first steps? I mean, really, it was about trying to create an injunction to stop the implementation, and I think that's initially what we filed. After that, where did it lead in regards to filing that injunction?
Right. So we initially looked at filing a temporary restraining order, which is the most expeditious way because we can go in on essentially very 24 hours notice to the other side and get a remedy as quickly as possible, and then tied that to a request for declaratory relief, which was essentially asking the court to look at this regulation in light of the legal authorities that we cited, Fair Employment and Housing Act, constitutional right to privacy, and declare that that regulation is unlawful. Again, even as we began preparing the pleadings to do this, we were still a bit dumbfounded by DOJ's failure to respond. We actually thought that maybe the holidays had slowed that down. There was some effort to reach back out to DOJ before we filed just to confirm that they got the letter, because it was crickets, absolutely nothing from them. And they, in a very, very curt way, said, yeah, we got it, and then nothing else. So we knew we had to file. So the idea was to come in very strong On a case like this, you want to make a very compelling argument right out of the gate, because the judge is not going to hear testimony or receive evidence outside of the pleadings. So we spent a couple of weeks solidly getting into pretty much everything about the history of this regulation, looking at the authorities that DOJ was actually relying on, debunked a lot of that, and then put together the strong arguments on those two grounds, the Fair Employment and Housing Act and then a privacy argument.
You know, I was looking at some of the notes that we have, and you know, it talks about, you know, the Attorney General going around the state right now saying that, you know, teachers can inform parents about, you know, the gender of their children if they're in school. I mean, the dichotomy there, it just seems really odd that, you know, in one sense he's over here saying, hey, you don't have to talk about your gender, but oh, if you're a peace officer and you make a traffic stop and there's data card, you do have to identify your gender. Do you want to talk? Either one of you want to talk about that?
It seems like there's a different rule for law enforcement officers, and that's what we're seeing from the government and from some of these entities. And you know, I mean, that was one of our points: is why would you treat this group of employees differently than you would any other employees? We had hoped, although I suspected that what was going on is exactly what was going on, that there was just a lack of concern for the officer's privacy rights. But we had hoped that it was maybe an oversight and a misunderstanding as to how RIPA worked, because I think your members already know all of this, but when an officer submits the information to their employing agency, and if they had had to, if we hadn't gotten the injunction, they had to disclose this information, they would be disclosing their gender identity to at least some other coworkers and city employees, and it would vary from agency to agency who had access to that information and how widely it was disseminated. But the protections in FEHA are against having to disclose that type of information to your employer. So at the hearing, the attorney from the DOJ was arguing that the information is anonymized, which is true. It's anonymized by the agency when it's reported to the DOJ, and so the public only gets to see a unique identifying number. But the judge was able to see our concern, which was that the employer has the key code, so to speak, between the unique identifying number and the officer's name, so that when an officer is reporting this information, they're necessarily being forced to disclose that information to their employer.
Can I add one other thing on that? At one point in the discussions, because we brought in the Cal Chiefs and the sheriffs, which is the management side, David and I were actually having a very candid conversation with the attorneys for the employers, saying, you understand, this is forcing you to violate the law. And we, as the advocates and representatives of the employees, if we have no other recourse, you're going to see lawsuits by our members against you for violating the statute. You should be out in front saying, DOJ, why are you forcing us to violate people's statutory rights?
Yeah, and they did actually join us on this case, which was really good to see. I think it just adds more weight to what we're trying to bring forward.
It was extremely helpful to have the state sheriffs and the Cal Chiefs as parties on this, side by side with the officers fighting for their privacy rights and telling the court through the pleadings that they didn't want to have to choose between violating the RIPA regulations or violating the Fair Employment and Housing regulations.
And I also want to recognize that the California Association of Highway Patrolmen was a participant in this. So we were happy to have this core group move this forward. I know some of the questions that I've gotten as I attend the chapter meetings was, okay, so if this regulation had gone forward, obviously, you know, we have some members that would like to keep their gender identity somewhat confidential. Implications for Senate Bill 2 for dishonesty. What are your thoughts on that, if you'd like to opine? I know it's separate from our case, but I'm looking at it as, what are the potential ramifications for our officers and how it could affect them for keeping their police certificate in California?
It's a huge concern. That was one of the key issues that we raised. And in addition to all of the legal authorities, is we got a lot of really good and strong declarations from the stakeholders like yourself, Jake Johnson, the president of CAHP, about individual members that are impacted by this. And Tim and I were looking through the administrative record when these regulations were enacted, and there's actually, you know, this an additional dichotomy where it seemed to be that DOJ was saying, well, the officers can choose how they want to respond, the obvious implication being they could choose whatever they want, yet the chiefs had provided us information that they had received from DOJ, scrutinizing them for the information and demanding that officers be punished and reported to SB2 or to post under SB2 if they weren't accurately filling out that information. And that's really the core of what we're fighting for, is not putting that officer in the position, and maybe it's only 1% or 2% of the membership where they have to choose between disclosing their most personal, intimate information before they're ready to do so, or subject themselves to accusations of false reporting.
And then I guess it sort of dovetails into, I guess if you're an officer for like the recruiting or retention component of it, I mean, it just seems like, obviously, over the last several years, we've gone through a lot as a profession. You know, there's a lot of toxic environment based. I sort of blame it on the elected officials for creating this environment. You know, during times of adversity, it'd be nice to see some elected officials stand up for the profession and be like, hey, it's a great job. We need people in the community that are willing to do this. And I know that abolish the police was like a real big thing, and actually probably was very detrimental for a lot of elected officials. But, you know, when you see stuff like this and you see the government saying on one hand, we want these privacy protections, but hey, once you pin a badge on, you don't get those privacy protections. I guess, you know, you deal with, you know, on the front line bargaining, because both of you bargain for associations. What are your thoughts and feelings regarding the recruitment and retention component, especially as you're going into contract negotiations with other associations throughout the state?
Well, what I would say is all the organizations that I deal with are always concerned about recruiting, right? As people retire and move out of this profession, naturally, you've got to have an influx of new people. And there's been a recognition that the pool from which you can draw officers has historically been somewhat limited. You know, people have complained that the demographics of law enforcement officers tend to fit a particular profile, and there's a desire to break that mold, so to speak, and be more reflective of the community. And so it is a bit of an interesting twist to say, we want to make this welcoming for people to come in that might not have been traditionally thinking about law enforcement, but at the same time, if you do, we're going to put up these other barriers. We're going to potentially embarrass you or make you feel uncomfortable about who you are coming into that profession. So while I haven't specifically dealt with this issue on the recruitment things, it seems to be the antithesis of what you would do to try to expand your pool, keep people here, and let them feel as though they can have a career as a law enforcement officer without all this secondary personal attacks.
Where does the litigation sit now? And then obviously moving forward, is there a way to maybe create better working conditions with the Attorney General's office so we don't have issues like this?
So the first part of your question, the judge granted the temporary restraining order, set a date for a hearing on a preliminary injunction, which is the next step in the process. In the interim, the Department of Justice reached out to us about settling this litigation, and we appreciate that. So we are in those settlement discussions right now. Wouldn't really be appropriate to comment on that. The hearing date got kicked forward to afford the parties time to try to resolve it. As to your second question, you know, sitting as the lawyer, it's not really our role, but it seems to me that the most obvious is for the head of the agency to speak with the head of the labor organizations and have a direct line of communication. I mean, it's obvious that something like this is going to have a major impact on the membership of not just PORAC and not just CAHP, but also Cal Chiefs and Cal State Sheriffs. And so, you know, I always think it's better to talk and try to resolve things at the earliest stage if it's possible to do so.
It almost seems like the RIPA board in and of itself has just taken on a life of wanting to create more policies and procedures around how we conduct our business, not what I feel is within the scope and purview of what RIPA was designed for, was to collect data, analyze that data, and then put out documents and reports stating, hey, these are recommendations that we improve. It almost seems like now that they're like creating this other now thing that we want to draft, create policies, and change policies, not only within an agency within the state of California, but also in regards to POST. You know, from this perspective in this lawsuit, I think it's really opened up our eyes in a sense that we as an organization, as a profession, need to step up more to make sure that when you have a group like RIPA, that they actually stay in the lane that they were designed and crafted through legislation versus being more proactive in trying to change the way we conduct business through our training, because they're not professionals. The vast majority of those members on the RIPA board, I bet you they've never filled out the RIPA card, first and foremost. So they're changing a policy on what we have to do out in the field, but they themselves have never actually filled the form out. Probably most of them only seen a piece of paper of what it looks like. But the second piece is trying to change the way POST conducts its business, I think is very problematic for us, because we would not allow that to happen in any other profession that's certified in the state of California. But for some reason, when it comes to law enforcement, people that are not professionals, have no background in it outside of the fact that they watch TV, are now dictating policies and procedures. You're both attorneys. You would probably not want a non-attorney telling you what you needed for an education to become an attorney. But yet, we're allowing this group, this committee, to do that in California, and I think that's wrong. So hopefully this case will get more people to be more involved in what's happening with the RIPA board, because we are very limited on how many public safety officers are on there. I think the commissioner's on there from CHP, Sheriff Chad Bianco's on there, Chief Rich Randolph is on there, and he's our representative. So I do want to appreciate you for all of the work that you're doing on this case. We'll obviously have to come back once all the settlement discussions are over. But I guess to close it out, and I know so we've had some settlement discussions. I don't know if you could maybe talk or maybe take a look at the tea leaves. But, do you think we have a good path forward to working out a good settlement with the Attorney General's office?
Well, like David said, it's a premature to get into what that path may look like. We do have a status conference on April 30th if we can't settle it. So that date is going to force something to happen. I think it's incumbent on, since we have prevailed up to this point, challenging a system that we say on its face is not lawful, the ball is really in the court of DOJ to come back with something to take those concerns off the table, and if they're able to do that, then I think there's a path forward. That's about all I can see coming down the line here.
Circling back to your comments about the RIPA board, I think that those concerns are spot on, and I would add that when you have an agency like RIPA that's analyzing this data, in order to have credibility with the public, they need to remain impartial so that they can look at this data and be trustworthy when they make their conclusions on it. And when they start blurring the lines into advocacy, you're well aware that they're sponsoring amendments to the Peace Officers Bill of Rights, they start to wear the shoes of an advocate, and it's inconsistent with being an impartial, neutral entity that's supposed to review this data and provide the public the truth rather than have an agenda and a point of view.
Yeah, and that's one of the main reasons that we do our own reports, because, like you said, they are more now an advocate for a depolicing model in California versus we're collecting this information, we're going to analyze it in an impartial way, and we're going to put out the information that we've received, to where they're changing their reports on an annual basis, so there's not even a baseline. You can't even take their very first report and compare it to the report that they're doing today. They've made so many changes in there. I just don't understand how a researcher can be like, yeah, we're going to get solid information on this, and this is the way we're going to move forward on changing police, when there's just no consistency in reporting. So, but with that, I will, again, thank you so much for coming in, discussing this case. I think it's important that we provide this information to the membership to let them know that we're working very hard for them up here in Sacramento. But also, you know, hopefully this sort of gets people to want to be involved in making sure and watching what RIP is doing. Even if you're calling in at the board meetings and providing information and stating that, hey, you know, they need to conduct business in an impartial way. And I think that would be very beneficial. So with that, I want to thank you and have a great day.
Thank you again for having us.
Thanks again for joining us for another episode of On the Job with PORAC. We hope you learned something new. We extend our deepest gratitude to all our PORAC members and to those who wear the badge. Thank you for your service. Stay safe out there, and we'll catch you on the next episode.